coming up. We'll have another break. Our evaluation forms and our pay for form. Fill them out, please. Leave them on the desk, you know, as you go out. And maybe I'll just have them.
Alternative presentations of material you find in other books. And if you look, you don't have to look could see, for example, that Deuteronomy is quoted in Jeremiah, that Jeremiah is quoted in Daniel, and so on and so on. So there is an ongoing response to Tanakh within the Tanakh, sometimes to parts of the Torah, sometimes to most Mosaic books. The process is the same. We can speak at great length about the nature of these interpretations, but ultimately they're all included in Scripture. And so if you ask yourself, well, is an interpretation defined in Ezra or Chronicles or someplace else binding? You have to deal in essence with the nature of the Bible itself, the nature of the Bible's relation, later Bible relation to earlier Bible, not the Torah, and so forth and so on. All these things have to be dealt with if one is going to try to confront the nature of that interpretation. Where do you find the first example of Bible interpretation in the Bible? Well, maybe in Genesis 1-2, which in some ways unpacks Genesis 1-1. But the truth is you find it in many, many places. All of the dreams that are stated and interpreted, all of the prophetic and shalim that are presented and explained. Every time you have a story that is recast, such as one when Abraham's servant goes to find a wife for Isaac, and the text tells the story, and then he gets there and tells the story over again. Every time you have a re-presentation of a text, you run into the question of what does this re-presentation mean, and are the differences between it and the other form of the text that we have significant? To jump ahead for a minute, the Midrashic answer to that question is always the differences are significant. But that is not the only rabbinic answer. If you look, for example, at the writings of Ibn Ezra, or of the Rashba, or others, you will see that they are committed to the position that the Torah itself repeats things in different words. It doesn't change, intend to change the meaning. And so one has to ask if every distinction is ultimately significant or not. That's a matter of assumption and analysis, but not a matter of law. The Bible is full of these representations. Let me move on. The next period of Bible interpretation is basically Greco-Roman. Much of this literature, almost all of this literature, was preserved by Christians, the big exception being the Dead Sea Scrolls. Philo Josephus comes from this time. For many, many centuries, Jews didn't study Philo Josephus, they were preserved in Greek. The Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, in this context, Pseudepigrapha is more important than the Apocrypha, contain largely Jewish books, books written by Jews in antiquity, but perhaps adapted as well as adopted by various Christian groups, which became important in some Christian circles for understanding the text, so the biblical studies of the resurrected link. Very, very interesting. And let us see some of the ways in which Jews in ancient times went about the business of reading the Tanakh. Josephus and Philo also, no one really in Jewish circles preserved these things. We had a Jewish book called Yosipon, which some people believe was in fact Josephus. Today that is generally not believed to be correct. Philo was made an honorary church father because his teachings about certain things seemed to be so congruous with those of the church that they saw him as a natural antecedent to many of their own teachings. This literature, which exists in a number of different forms, a form we call translation, a form we call pesher, which is a kind of applying biblical text to the contemporary Europe, in philosophical allegory and in other forms, is perhaps best represented by rewriting of biblical texts. Josephus' Antiquities, for example, produced in the first century, are largely a summary, of the Bible. And it's interesting to go back and to look carefully at the biblical texts we have and at Josephus to see not only what he chose to say and not say, but how he chose to retell and rework materials that you find in the Tanakh itself. I'm not going to say any more about this literature, all of which was either preserved by Christians or discovered by archaeologists, because none of it was preserved by the rabbinic tradition. The only echoes we have of it in the rabbinic tradition, and we have some, are preserved in Chazal without attributing most of what they say to these sources. In other words, we do have passages that talk about the Septuagint, the Greek translation, Chazal knew about it. And there are references the result of two factors. One of them is that this other literature was used more extensively by either Greco-Roman Jews or Christians, and so the rabbis basically avoided it. The other is that there was, as a result of the first position, a conscious attempt on their part to censor this material out of existence. I think we see this at least in two Mishnayot, one in Sanhedrin and one in Avot, where rabbis list people who have shared or have no share in the world to come, and they include about a dozen examples, that all of which can be associated relatively easily with different sectarian groups in antiquity and their individual interpretations or practices related to the Bible. And so it looks like, all else aside, there was a conscious attempt by the early rabbis, at least by the time of the Mishnah, to cut off this literature and people associated with it, and to say, if you want to share the world to come, you study the Torah our way, and you do it the way you want. At the same time, if you do it their way, you're out of business. That's not the only ancient rabbinic attitude. You also have in that same Mishnah a teaching associated with an individual that says, turn it over and over, everything is in it, and this in many ways has become the basis for the entire process of trying to continually apply the Bible to later times. When dealing with the question of why certain ancient books of certain ancient prophets were included in Scripture and others were not, one of the early rabbinic answers is those things we need forever were included, and those things that were needed only for temporal considerations were not. And this, too, drives this force that I talked about before, continually to apply the Bible, and in some ways to avoid its ancient context. One of the major considerations in Chazal was for the Torah. You don't need me to tell you that. If you open the Talmud, some 60% of the Bible quotations are from the Torah. Interestingly enough, about 7% are from the Rishonim. And of the rest, Isaiah and Psalm get most of the attention. Clearly, the Torah was way out of proportion in importance to everything else. And other specific books were also important, but the whole corpus itself did not get an equal amount of attention. That was probably the case forever in Judaism, and it still is. In Christianity, it changed around the 4th and 5th centuries. So if you look at these statistics in early Christianity, they're the same as they are in Jewish sources. But by the time that the Christian literature has evolved, you get a much more balanced treatment of the material. It's more or less equal between Torah and Ketuvim. And even though those are not equal in size, because the Torah, the Bibishani, and the Honorary of the Tumor are four equal quarters of Tanakh, still we get a much more balanced distribution in the Tristic literature. We're Torah people, over and over and over again. One of the things that happened as part of the emphasis on Torah was the introduction of a process called Midrash. Now, the word Midrash actually occurs in the Bible, although it's not clear what it means there. It's a name of a book. So we don't know what kind of book. It's a book associated with a prophet about whom we also don't know a great deal. And so there isn't a whole lot you can say about it other than it's there. But the word Arash means to seek an oracle. One goes to the Rosh Hashem, or to inquire in a case, a law case, in order to analyze the details that are presented. By the time of the rabbis, the word Arash is used in a very different way. It means basically to understand, to expound the biblical text. And I think that what has happened here is that the transition has gone from an oracular society where people still communicated with God or heard God directly to an exegetical society where you determine the divine will by reading and decoding it from a revealed text. And so when someone engages in drash or drash, you prefer, what he's doing is determining the divine will from the text. And the techniques of drash, or of midrash, while they have never been listened to fully, are really the dynamics by which the rabbis pursue this activity. Many people have tried to define drash over the years. I don't think they've been totally successful. I would define midrash in the following way. I think midrash is material about the Bible. It is attributed to the rabbis of the Talmudic era, not necessarily originally here, but attributed to them in some cases. 42 rules, not just 32 rules that we cite in Dominic Day or the 32 associated with Rabbi Eliezer, the notion of Rabbi Yosef ben Gamliel, or other lists of rules that have been recorded, mentioned, but we can develop further. But there are extensive hermeneutical procedures by which the rabbis manipulate the text. And all of these are part of the definition of Midrash. Reading Hebrew words as if they're Greek is a strategy that Chazal used sometimes. I don't know if that actually occurs in any of the lists, but it's an example of the dynamic that one would have to put in any such inclusive taxonomy. But anyway, the goals of Midrash, I think, are to expand, glorify, and apply the Bible. Doesn't say anything about telling you what the Bible actually meant. It doesn't say anything about telling you what actually happened. It doesn't say anything about the truth. It doesn't say anything about the unique, definitive meaning of the text. We all know that these questions have been debated for centuries as far as what the Midrash will about. So I would prefer to leave all that out of the definition. It's to expand, glorify, and apply the Bible. And Midrash is very successful. Its impact on the other Jewish readings of the Bible cannot be overestimated. And I dare say, I say this to the Bible critics as well as anybody else, Midrash is probably the most sensitive exegetical literature ever created. There are no textual problems moderns have discovered that are not discussed in the Midrash. And when you find one, it's really true. I mean, basically, they soil. You may not like the answers. They answer the text problems as they so fit. But the Midrashim are extremely sensitive to texts. And if you go back after you've isolated some contemporary issue raised by critics of one sort or another, and look at the Midrashim in response to the text, I would say almost invariably you'll find the Midrashim have actually confronted the question one way or another. You may have recognized for that. They're very, very sensitive. Sensitive to language, sensitive to nuance, sensitive to reconstructing the context that the story suggests, and so forth. Midrash is extremely valuable. But it isn't the only way to look at the text. And people often forget that during the time of Chazal, none of the Midrashic exegesis was also. The best proof of this, I think, is in the Targumim, where you find extensive literal translations of the text. Now, the paraphrase of Aramaic, and all of the paraphrases are not absolutely identical to the originals, but the bottom line is that every Midrash is not incorporated into Targumim, although many were. And the rabbis did understand the difference between the literal meaning of the text and non-literal meanings of the text. And you see them use literal meanings all the time in the non-literal exegesis. I had a teacher many years ago who used to say that every day when you say Kriya Shema, you should also say Chazal in Hebrew. Just like that. He didn't mean you should say in the middle of Kriya Shema, but he meant this was a dogma of faith. But you had to understand the rabbis didn't know what they were talking about. And if they gave him kashim, or they played with the text, manipulated it, then they knew that they were doing that. There is a fairly vast literature, medieval Jewish as well as contemporary, that suggests that rabbis did not know what they were doing, and that they really thought the meanings of the text were not what they were, and that their interpretations were in fact the text. I don't think that's fair. Everything that I have said up to now, and I have to move on because I don't have so much time. Everything that I have said up to now is predicated on the existence of an unvocalized Bible text. If you go to the story today by Tanakh, you get it with vowels, verse markers, truck, and all kinds of other helpful additions that did not exist until this time. And so everything about the Bible in ancient times, everything about the Bible in the time of Chazal, has to be understood and has been done without the benefit of that system. It's only really with the development of the Masoretic text, as it is known, in post-Talmudic times, that we get the fully evolved text that you see in the Bible today. Open up the Sacred Torah, you have a much better idea of what the Bible text looked like 2,000 years ago. The printed Bible is more representative of what the Bible looked like 1,000 years ago. In the Masoretic codices, where it was vocalized and had candlish marks, and other issues too, which are usually left out, that we call the Masoretic. This was produced a little more than 1,000 years ago, and it was a watershed in terms of developing the Jewish response to the Hebrew Bible. What you have to remember is that part of this globalization knowledge and understanding of the text as the Masoretic presents it with its vowels and its syntactic units, unless it's frequently feel free to go their own ways. The Gilonim, who lived around the same time, had as among their tasks the responsibility of responding to the defining of the role of authority of things like the Talmud and the Targum and the Midrashim. They also had to deal with other kinds of things as well. They didn't really evaluate the Masoret very much, that came somewhat later. But the fact is that this was a crucial period in defining the nature of Judaism. By the time you get to the Middle Ages, and you start talking about Rashi and Rashbam, and many other famous medieval writers who commented on the text, we have entered a different world of discourse. One of the dominant themes or trends of medieval interpretation is collecting Midrashim and trying to use them to expand the text. But another, perhaps even more important and creative trend, is just the opposite. There is a tendency to try to understand the text without the benefit of Chazal, to try to read independently as works of Hebrew literature, and to develop the tools necessary to do that. Now remember, until the Middle Ages, there are no grammarians and no grammar. Many people talk about Sadigo, who was the first grammarian. And if he wasn't the first, he surely wasn't too far away. There were no grammar books in Hebrew at the time of Chazal, at least on the Noah. There were grammar books in any other languages at that time. As far as we know, the first Hebrew grammars, which were grammars of the biblical dialect, were produced really in the only times, and then they were refined over the centuries throughout the Middle Ages. Those tools changed the whole nature of the endeavor. Because what you do with grammar book and dictionary, and many would produce, is very different. And the way, of course, that we create these is by very, very detailed, careful, systematic study of the biblical text. And that's what the early texts were. They were collecting the Likud from the Masoret, the comments, the masterpieces, some of the material that cuts off as well, and they were trying to structure it into a systematic understanding of the language. Philosophical interpretation was also highly developed in the Middle Ages. There's a lot we can say about Maimonides and his followers, the extent to which they actually were committed to the literal meaning of the text or violated it in other philosophical allegorical ways. There were major controversies about Maimonides' interpretation and that of his followers. But philosophical interpretation was important. And one of the other major trends that you see, you don't see it as much in Chazal, but you see it much more in the Middle Ages, and it's still a debate until today, is the extent to which external intellectual systems should play a role in Bible interpretation. Should Greek philosophy be allowed to influence the way in which the Bible is understood, or is it something foreign and therefore inappropriate? Is grammar a matter which really developed from Muslim writers who wrote about Iranian grammar and language? This debate goes on. It's with us still today. Kabbalah developed in the Middle Ages. In some ways, it's a resurgence of earlier Midrash interests. In some ways, it's very different. But all of these serve as different tools, if you want to use that word, different spirits of interpretation from the medieval times. There are others, but let them go on. One of the interesting developments that you have in this book is the synthesis of all of these things. In other words, there's a recognition that there are many, many different ways to read the text, and what I spoke about this morning, of having many different approaches, actually gets concretized in the Middle Ages. At first, people talk about parnes, pshat, remez, rashi, so four different approaches or literatures of interpretation. But by the 16th century, we had mystics talking about 600,000 panim on Torah, essentially admitting that there's a different interpretation for every individual, and even the notion that since everybody has four different individual interpretations, parnes, so you have 2.4 million interpretations of the Torah potentially available. Now, this is very different from the notion of there being one independent reading. And it really leads us in a whole different direction when it sounds very postmodern, because the reader counts rather than the text. But by the time you get to the 16th, 17th century, you find that exegesis is much more varied in its approaches. All of this literature is potentially available. Some is liked in some circles, others parts that are not. People tend to prefer different directions. And eventually, what I would describe as three different trends evolve. One of them that I would call Midrashic Zohar. Another one is Talmudic Midrashic, and a third we'll call rational scientific. Each of these trends is anchored by the traditional Jews who develop it in different aspects of the pre-existent rabbinic literature. The Zohar Midrashic types are interested, obviously, in Zohar and Midrash. They are more mystical. In some circles, many of these people might be called Hasidic, although I don't want to use that term here because I don't want to confuse the labels. We're talking about a form of Bible study and some other ideological issue. But these are people who are Zohar and Midrash. If you look at their commentaries, these are the sources that they privilege in terms of what they're doing. A second group is Talmudic Midrash. They're not so interested in the Zohar. They're more interested in the Talmud. There are commentaries actually produced between the 17th and 20th centuries, 19th centuries. If that, when you read that, and what you read about is not the history of Rashi and Rashbam and the Ezra and so forth, but you read about the great Talmudic writers, because that's what these people knew. And so the commentaries on the Torah are basically all about the Rashi and the Rashbam and the Talmud and some of the later Talmud.